This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. This week, we're going to dedicate the entire program to the issue of so-called Black identity extremists, the term the FBI invented to justify its permanent witch hunt against Black individuals and organizations that fight for Black people's rights and interests in the United States. Human rights activists regard the Black identity extremist label as part of the FBI's attempt to repackage for the 21st century its old and discredited COINTELPRO dirty war against Black and left-wing organizers.
Some of those activists recently formed an umbrella group to coordinate the resistance to the FBI's latest offensives against Black people. It's called the Black Identity Extremist Abolition Collective. The collective plans to hold political education and organizing events in cities across the nation. The first session was held at the People's Forum in Midtown Manhattan, New York City. Five organizers representing key human rights groups were unexpectedly joined by Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner. They discussed the threat posed by the FBI's attempt to demonize and neutralize radical politics in the Black Lives Matter era. Ajamu Sankofa is one of the founders of the Black Identity Extremist Abolition Collective.
I'm a member of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, and I'm also part of a collective that met in April of 2018 to figure out what is the FBI assessment, Black identity extremists set to target the police. It was a bit shocking when a lot of activists looked at this, particularly those who were operating in D.C., but as we discovered and researched and looked at it, it appears to be and is a continuation of how the FBI has been looking at and targeting dissidents, resistors, social justice and racial justice activists for a very, very, very long time. It's like it's endemic in their DNA of what they're supposed to do to support and defend property rights and the elite. The mission of the collective that organized around this had various names. We haven't really decided what our name needs to be. You can help us figure that out because we're all in this together. But the mission is to end unlawful police surveillance of racial justice activists. And to do that by initiating nationally a public education campaign and strategy sessions. Rhetorically, I have a question that sticks in the back of my mind. And that question is, whenever has there been a social justice movement capable of stopping unlawful state surveillance of those who complain, resist, criticize, question, and seek to change the quality of their lives such that they're no longer oppressed? This collective, when it started, consisted of a few organizations: the National Lawyers Guild, the Transformative Justice Coalition out of D.C., and it has been growing. And we hope that this is the first of our discussions in New York, when it's going to take place in D.C. in June, to be part of an ongoing national effort to rebuild a social justice, democratic-based movement, which is now nascent. I mean, it's emerging, so that we have the capacity to defend our rights against what is a very dangerous and insidious assessment racial profiling of black activists. What we know is that the FBI sent out this assessment to 18,000 of its affiliates throughout the United States. We also know that they have gone to black churches to seek assistance from these black churches to identify folks who fit the profile. So just sit on that for a moment. The FBI is actively attempting to pit the black community against its own racial justice activists. I mean, where are we? What is this? Johanna and I have been friends for a long time, and the other day we kind of thought out loud, how do you talk about this in a way that doesn't sound hyperbolic? How can you help us assess the urgency of the time? Why is it that we don't have an anti-war movement? Where is the social movement for workers' justice? Where is that power of people with agency to affect quality change? And to the extent that people do that, the pattern has been that the state comes down to squash them. What we have also discovered through the first case that came to light in 2017 in Texas, a state that has open carry, a young black man who had guns because he's part of the gun culture of Texas. He's a hunter, and he's also organizer against police brutality. The FBI started to surveil him because he fits the profile of somebody likely to attack the police because he's pissed off at police getting away with killing of black men and women, brown men and women, historically. This has been going on forever. You know, this is not new to minority communities vis-a-vis the police. So all of a sudden, this incendiary assessment came to light. But why and why now? How many of you are familiar with the counterintelligence program known as COINTELPRO? There is a thought among some activists, not all, that somehow COINTELPRO was exposed and ended in 1971 because of the Church Committee recommendations. What many folks don't know that COINTELPRO came into existence, quote unquote, I mean, the name COINTELPRO came into existence around 1956. I was just thinking, well, you know, in 1954, Board of Education decision, when that decision came down, and around that time the French had lost in Vietnam, where the United States was a primary supporter, you had this thing that percolated up from the FBI to kind of sit on dissent. And it targeted black people, people of color, and workers resisting. That is not a coincidence. There is a nexus between every time people of color rise up or have an opportunity, if it's no more than to believe that they have hope for a better day, then the state takes notice to push them down. And that pattern has been repeated. What else do we need to know? We don't know what criminal cases have come into existence as a result. Charges have been filed, arrests have been made. Maybe some of these speakers may know, because the FBI does not reveal its involvement in cases. The case that I just talked about, Brother Christopher Daniels, there was no record of FBI involvement in his case. No one knew. Who knows? I mean, the nature of it is secret. So when you have COINTELPRO was exposed. It was exposed by activists going in and stealing documents and all that. It was exposed. There was a social movement, as I'm reminded by my good buddy, that existed at the time that was part of why the government responded in a way to curtail it. But did you know that in 1981, Ronald Reagan began to create an assessment to pull back the restrictions that have been placed on COINTELPRO, quote unquote, and that Clinton went on to do that, to continue those assessments, and Bush did the same thing with the Patriot Act, and now we have this assessment. And all the while, we have a society where three white men who are rich own more wealth than the bottom 50%. I mean, there's something fundamentally unsustainable about this picture. And the FBI continues, it's not a conspiracy theory to think of them as the secret cabal, but it's functioning with a determination to preserve the status quo, to preserve the privilege. And it uses the rationale of terrorism, international terrorism, anything to hide behind the means by which to repress democracy and repress people voicing their need to thrive and be free. But I want to leave here with some folks signing on to how we can continue these discussions, deepen these discussions, because you all are frontline activists. You all are in the streets demonstrating on a variety of issues. And you have a state apparatus limiting your success at your own expense. And for people who claim to be freedom fighters, you know, and advocates for, you know, a more humane, democratic society, that is unacceptable. And there's no reason to think that somehow by simply lobbying the Democratic Party or whomever to change, you end up chasing your tail, because their imperative is much larger than what you've defined it to be. So we want to talk through what that looks like in practice, what we can do about it, and not have a sense of losing and cynicism, because we are the Democratic majority. We have the capacity to define what law is based on our morality and to codify that. And so that's our challenge in this beginning discussion, because every mass event needs to be the foundation for the next mass event. One thing I did not say, which I don't think I need to talk about, is this maniac who's the President of the United States and the complicity of the Republican Party in this. You give us the language. What is it? It's more than a constitutional crisis. It's the collapse of the rule of law in this country. And that's very, very frightening and should incentivize us to fight back in a deliberate, protracted, and smart way.
That was Ajamu Sankofa of the National Conference of Black Lawyers and the Black Identity Extremist Abolition Collective.
My Aisha Hayes is with the Center for Media Justice, which has challenged the FBI's reincarnation of COINTELPRO. Hayes knows all too well that the Bureau's aim is to turn Black activists into political prisoners.
My grandfather was a member of the Black Panther Party, and growing up, like, his experience incredibly informed and shaped my politics. I grew up listening to him talk about working on the Free Breakfast Program, working with real righteous people, and also organizing Know Your Rights trainings and cop watches in Harlem and the Bronx. And so in many ways, like, his experience in the Panther Party really motivated me and inspired me to become a community organizer, particularly on criminal justice issues. And in his stories, when he's talking about organizing with the Panther Party, a consistent theme of that is surveillance and the criminalization of Black radical organizing for liberation and freedom. When he talks to me about organizing on the Free Breakfast Program, you know, he talked about getting business owners to donate their funds and resources and food, eggs, whatever, to help them feed Black children, and also would notice how cops were following them, harassing them. And they did this regularly, whether or not you were politically involved or active in any sort of party, but it was well understood within the Panther Party that they were being criminalized and watched. And so, growing up, like, I always had this understanding that, like, while it's really righteous to be involved in this work, there's consequences that come with it. There's personal sacrifices that come with doing this work. My grandfather, like so many other people, were surveilled through the COINTEL program and subsequently had to deal with that surveillance impacting their organizing work. And ultimately, it led to him being incarcerated by the age of like 28 in 1973. And this is after COINTELPRO was exposed. For the next 45 years, he remained incarcerated. It really impacted our family, our life. And I'm happy to say that, you know, he returned home last summer after serving 45 years and made his last 10th parole board hearing. And I'm happy to talk about, you know, that aspect later, too, about, you know, the movement to free our political prisoners and the need for parole reform. But when I heard about the Black Identity Extremist designation, it reminded me in such a profound way, like, the influence of my grandfather and why I got into this work, because of the personal sacrifice and consequences that he has made and so many others to fight for our liberation. And there's so many parallels, too, with the Black Identity Extremist designation and the sort of criminalization and surveillance that the Panthers endured, you know, over 50 years ago. I mean, back then they were saying that the Panther Party was this domestic terrorist group and that they were as bad as the KKK. And it wasn't because of the free breath. I mean, the free breakfast program was amazing and really crucial, but it wasn't just because of the breakfast program that the police state was surveilling them. The Panthers were forthright in their criticism of state-sanctioned violence and the history of police brutality in the Black community completely. That's what the state found threatening. And so when we look at the Black Identity Extremist designation today and see the way that they have turned Black people's protesting and organizing in response to police brutality day, today we're looking at the same thing. We're looking at the evolution of COINTELPRO into a new name called the Black Identity Extremist designation. And I think it's really important to call out the falseness of it, right? Because they tied these isolated incidents of violence towards police by Black people as an indication that there is some racially motivated group, a domestic terrorist group. But the year before this report was leaked, most of the violence committed towards cops were done by white people. I mean, there's studies coming out all the time about how some of the most deadly violent acts of domestic terrorism are committed by white nationalist groups. So what is a Black identity extremist? Where did that come from? It comes from this history and this legacy of surveilling Black folks and Black organizing. And so at Media Justice, which is the organization that I'm representing today, when the report was released, we immediately like swung into action and filed a FOIA request to understand the scope of the designation in the surveillance program. And of course, we got a bunch of redacted documents and information. But nevertheless, that's still important. I think some of where our power comes from is recognizing that we have a right to demand transparency, and we have a right to demand to understand what the FBI is calling domestic terrorism and challenge that. And so after we filed that FOIA request and didn't get the information that we requested, we then filed a lawsuit against the FBI demanding full disclosure of what we asked for. And in addition to that, launched a petition, which currently now has over 50,000 signatures supporting our demand. Recently, the FBI said in a Homeland Security meeting that they're not using the BIE designation anymore. And so some folks are saying, oh, haven't we kind of won? Isn't that a victory? Yes and no, right? I mean, yes in the sense that they're responding. They see the backlash and the criticism and all of these different groups, including, you know, Media Justice, responding. But we know from the history of surveillance that these terms evolve. They called it COINTELPRO. There were restrictions that got pulled back. And now we're here with the Black Identity Extremist designation. So just because they're not calling it BIE, doesn't mean that they're not looking into Black organizers and surveilling our movements. And in fact, they said that they are not using this term anymore, but they reorganized their domestic terrorism categories to include a more blanket term, racially motivated extremism. And so essentially what they're trying to do is say, we're not saying BIE, but Black folks who have these extreme ideologies are comparable with white nationalists and white supremacy, which is factually not true. So the fight is gonna continue. our campaign, we're part of the collective as well. We're working on creating more space to coordinate with folks working on this issue. You know, I think that one of the things that we do is we work on digital security trainings to both educate our communities around the history of surveillance, but also to provide some tips and resources on how to protect and secure your organizing. Because what is, despite all of the parallels and similarities, there is a little bit of a difference today in the sense that, you know, a lot of organizers are using the internet and social media to organize and connect with people. So Facebook and Twitter and, you know, Instagram are like really important spaces for us online. But at the moment, a lot of these platforms are cooperating with the police. So for instance, one of the ways in which Media Justice got involved with some of the hate content on Facebook was because when Corinne Gaines was defending herself against the police, suddenly the video and her account was taken offline. And Facebook has done this repeatedly with the protests at the North Dakota pipeline. All of a sudden, activists couldn't live stream their standoff with the police. And so today, some of the ways in which we talk about securing our movements also have to include the way that we sharpen our analysis about the roles in which technology and social media platforms play a role in undermining our movements as well. And so our digital security trainings also get into that. How do you identify doxing, harassment, and fake accounts, which are tactics that the police do, right? Like it was reported in Memphis that the local police department there was setting up fake accounts and friending Black Lives Matter activists, trying to gain information from them, trying to disorganize their organizing.
That was my Aisha Hayes of the Center for Media Justice.
The New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights has been in the forefront of the resistance to the FBI's attempt to criminalize political organizing and speech, especially in Black and Muslim communities. Aya Syed represented the center at the People's Forum in New York.
So I was born and raised in Saudi Arabia, and I came here about a year before 9/11. And I remember before 9/11 even happened, hearing stories of elders in the mosque talking about the ways in which they were surveilled in the 70s and in the 60s as members of the Nation of Islam. And there being this extreme fascination, I think, of all of us young people around stories of surveilling of, you know, Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali and the ways in which these figures had sort of been seen as domestic terrorists. And shortly thereafter, 9/11 happened. And as you all can imagine, in a lot of ways, that created a kind of hysteria around wanting to criminalize and identify and oppress Muslims, both globally but also domestically. And in particular, what it ended up doing is it provided the federal government and state agencies essentially with a mandate to really militarize the ways in which they're fighting this really amorphous definition of terror. And so what happened right after 9/11 is, despite the fact that these are all historic practices, but now they were given really the ammunition to go about equipping themselves with drones and technologies that are now modern, that are sophisticated, that are extremely aggressive and difficult to pinpoint, and utilize them not only to fight the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and ISIS and whomever abroad, but really also use those tools domestically, not only against Muslims, but also amongst Black folks and folks in general. So just to give you all a bit of a look into what that looks like now, so I work at the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is a movement, lawyering, and advocacy shop that really does a broad range of work in this space. It started off in the sort of Black liberation struggle in the Deep South and has since developed into an organization that works on Guantanamo Bay issues. In fact, we were one of the first organizations to represent Guantanamo Bay inmates. It's also now working very heavily on issues of prisoner rights through the Pelican Bay, and also a wider range of international human rights issues, like issues in Palestine and et cetera. But we've recently actually similarly filed a FOIA with the Color of Change to try to unearth documents that demonstrate the ways in which the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security are really targeting a movement for Black Lives activists. After a few years of litigation, we actually finally got our hands on a series of emails that not only demonstrated exactly what it is that we were talking about, which is that they were, the FBI and DHS were identifying Black activists and then surveilling them very intentionally because of their activities of protest, but also, interestingly, we uncovered that there's a belief that ISIS and the Muslims are, quote-unquote, co-opting the movement, that there was evidence they unearthed that ISIS was, in fact, supporting protesters in Baltimore and that they were calling on protesters in Baltimore who were rising up against the death of and murder of Freddie Gray, saying that ISIS is now taking advantage of the situation, calling on people to join them in their fight in Syria, and how the Muslim state is an alternative to what Black people are fighting against. We also uncovered documents that suggest that there are Muslim activists in Ferguson who wanted to not only co-opt the movement, but actually leverage it as a way to spread certain ideologies. And what was really, I think, fascinating about some of the documents that we unearthed is, you know, obviously a part of it is a bit sadly predictable. What we realized is, in a really sophisticated way, the FBI and DHS recognized that there's this profound fight against white supremacy. And while the issues and the causes and the calls to action are radically different, because in no way can you put movement for Black lives in the same conversation as ISIS, there is this really profound struggle against the technologies of white supremacy. There is in some way some continuity across the globe, and so they're fighting, this sort of state apparatus is fighting and categorizing all of our struggles as similar, if not the same, in their eyes. And I think there's power in recognizing that while some of our issues, aka, you know, like Muslim domestic rights issues or Black civil rights issues, are bifurcated, I think there is power in really realizing the intersectionalities of these issues and fighting against them as one massive block, because the reality is we're being perceived as one massive block. So without that sort of unity, it really becomes a difficult, you know, apparatus to fight against. And then one other quick example I wanted to plug in is a case that we recently settled in 2018 called Hassan v. the City of New York. So I don't know if you all were following the case. It was a big settlement, in large part because the NYPD had to shell out a lot of money. But it was essentially a response, just by way of a background, to media reports that were beginning to piece together the ways in which the NYPD was really mapping out Muslim communities, not only in New York, but in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania. And they found that the NYPD created this really Orwellian 21st century map of Muslims by surveilling over 20,000 Muslims in New York and Jersey and in the tri-state area, by focusing in on over 20 businesses, I believe 30 restaurants, and over 10 schools. And that means that they were literally listening in on and following and surveilling college students, high school students who did nothing other than go to a Muslim Student Association meeting. So once this information was uncovered, CCR, along with our allies at Muslim Advocates, filed a massive lawsuit on behalf of all the Muslim plaintiffs who were surveilled by the NYPD and ended up winning this settlement, a part of which included that they created a civilian board that now looks at all the ways in which the NYPD is surveilling communities and has to approve in some bizarre way, though it's not really effective, the strategies that they employ. But one quick thing that was really remarkable about the lawsuit is we also uncovered documents that suggested the way in which the NYPD was going about surveilling people was by categorizing folks into what they deemed to be ethnicities of interest. And one of these ethnicities of interest are Black Muslims, essentially Black American Muslims. So not only Black immigrants coming from Somalia and Sudan, but also just straight up Black folks who are Muslim and just happen to be living in the NYPD and in the tri-state area. And again, it sort of really crystallizes and solidifies this idea of the ways in which the technologies that were once used to fight against ISIS and Al-Qaeda are actually now being used and are repurposed and are reused to fight against our own communities at home. And that this is particularly dangerous for not only Muslims in the U.S. and black people in the U.S., but particularly for black Muslims in the United States, for whom the realities of surveillance are longstanding. They started well before 9/11, but are now particularly dangerous, and that there is really no recourse of action that is just as strong and just as industrial, really, as the problem that we're sort of facing. And so I hope that we sort of start to see these similarities, intersections, and begin to build around them accordingly.
That was Aya Syed of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
King Downing is a veteran human rights worker and a member of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. He's also part of the group that founded the Black Identity Extremist Abolition Collective.
Stokely said something 40 years ago that is just as true today as it was back then. He said, "We are past the time for description. The time is now for prescription. We got to stop talking about the problem. We got to figure out what to do about it. We don't need any more information about COINTELPRO. A little more is helpful. Don't you have enough now to take some action, to give it a good kick you know where? You have enough information now?" So that's what I would like to contribute to the conversation is, what are we going to do about it? So please feel free, take down some notes. If you have some things to add to it, that's going to be part of the conversation. And so there are three areas where I'm going to suggest that ways that we take action. We must fight black identity extremism in our personal lives. Second, we must fight black identity extremism in our lives as protesters. And third, we must fight black identity extremism in our lives as members of organizations. So on the first one, we're going to fight black identity extremism in our personal lives. Here are some things that we will want to do. The first one is, we have to stop believing the hype. You hear some of the things they say, oh, this government is all-knowing. Oh, they listening to us now. Oh, they here now. Oh, they following everything we do. Every time we do that, we're digging ourselves in a little deeper and adding some paranoia that keeps us from thinking we can win or thinking we can take action. We want to be scientific, but it becomes a faith-based initiative when you think without evidence that they are everywhere all the time doing everything and can stop us. So we want to be careful about how they do it. And history has shown that they may slow things. As Brother Jamu said, they may slow things down, but they can't stop them. And history will prove that. To my second point, we must fight black identity extremism when we're dealing with protests. And here are a list of action items I want to run through briefly. The first level of attack that the system has used is in our dissent and our attempts to get out in the street. That's the first place that they attack, and that's part of the BIE and the COINTELPRO process. We don't really think of it that way. Their goal is to shut us down by any means necessary. So we have to start off by knowing our constitutional rights. What role does the First Amendment play? The Fourth Amendment? Oh, under which basis can they stop us and keep us from doing the things we want to do? And what ways are we able to say what we want to say and stand where we want to stand? So our foundation is going to be to know what laws we operate. I became a lawyer because I saw how Huey Newton whipped out the law book while he was doing the community patrols and said, under so-and-so Oakland code, we have the right to carry weapons in the city, and they, as long as we're in the vehicle, they cannot be loaded. But I am outside the vehicle right now, so I'm loading the weapon. And that was the beginning of the anti-gun campaign, if you want to really know when it began. Okay, it was against the Panthers. So for us dealing with these organizations, in addition to knowing our rights, when we're at these protests, we have to keep our eyes and ears open. We have to look for things that stand out, that are unusual, that are out of the ordinary. We also, of course, want to be aware of the police, and that's in all of their formations. What structures? How are they dressed? Are they relaxed? Are they moving forward? What agencies are there? You know, what insignia are they wearing? When we were down at the protests at the Venezuelan embassy a few weeks ago, we saw a new law enforcement agency on the ground wearing military uniforms, the Secret Service. They were in charge of the streets at that time. We had never seen that before. So we want to pay attention to those kinds of things. Are they in plain clothes? Are they operating undercover? We have to always make note of those kinds of things. Also, we have to be on the lookout for provocateurs, people who are stirring things up. But we have to be careful about that, because we can't assume that everybody who's doing something whose politics we don't agree with is an agent or an informant or a provocateur. Some people who want to just lock arms and sing think the provocateurs are sitting down in the middle of the street. No, those are people who are using civil disobedience as a tactic, and there are other people who believe in self-defense. And when the police attack, they defend themselves. So we can't just automatically launch into the fact that people are provocateurs without doing some observation and being scientific about it. So we don't want to jump to conclusions. We want to recognize the different tactics. Also, while we're looking out for the police, for the informants, the provocateurs, we also want to pay attention to the alt-right. Now going to protest has become a form of three-dimensional chess. It used to be us and the police. Now it's us, the police, and the alt-right. They have a First Amendment right to be out there. So we're going to watch them, but we're not going to trip off everything they do until they cross the line. When they threaten our people, or when they make any moves or taunt our people, and more importantly, when they show their true stripes by collaborating with the police. And we saw in Portland how the alt-right ran up, got flex cuffs from the police, and helped arrest protesters. If anybody's had any personal experience with any of these events I'm naming, raise them, because some people who may be there may have things to contribute to the conversation. We have also seen the police collaborate with the alt-right. So at a protest in Kentucky, after the city fought every attempt for the people who were protesting the right to try to have those protests, the police let the right-wing people plug into City Hall after having denied that to the left for years and years. Just let them plug in their sound systems and everything. So we have to pay attention to those things, because those let us know who's on which side and where they stand. Also, when it comes to protests, we have to pay attention to technical. I want to raise this because this was part of one of the areas that Ajamu was asking me to particularly address. We're seeing the use of technology in our surveillance. Some of it's unseen, but a lot of it is seen, and we have to pay attention to that too. Police filming us. Unfortunately, the courts have said they have a right to film us. It's our position that they don't have a right to film us unless we are breaking the law. But they're doing it, and so we want to know who is doing it and what are they filming. We have to pay close attention to that. Now there's some more surreptitious devices that are being used. One of them is called phone trackers or cell site simulators. And you will see vans around the protests. And the vans have little antennas on them, and what they're doing is they're pretending that they're a cell phone tower, and they're sucking in all of our calls, phone numbers and all of that. So we want to pay attention looking for those vans. Other cell site trackers look like little antennas that police can handhold, and you may see them walking around with those. So we want to pay attention to those. And where are they positioned? And where does that person go after they walk off with that radio, and what's the license plate of that vehicle so we know what agency it is? Also, we're seeing a level of aerial surveillance that we haven't seen in a long time. The use of planes. Check this all out. In Baltimore, people who habitually use their binoculars to check the tail numbers of planes, which is the federal license plates, were tracking planes that were circling over the protests in Baltimore. They also found that you can go online and you can get the flight patterns of these planes. So when you go to the website and you look at that plane and that flight, you can see the circles on the printout around and around over West Baltimore during these protests. So these folks went back and they tracked the tail numbers, and guess what they found? These were planes that were tracked back to shell companies that were held by the FBI. And we didn't know what the planes were doing, and through other research we found out that some technology that was privately developed and used in Iraq, where a plane circles and takes a digital photograph every second, a digital picture every second. So what were they doing circling around the protest, taking digital pictures of what every second?
Protests.
Protests, everything. By running these things forward and backwards, you can see every vehicle that came to the protest and every person, and you can run it backwards and find out what car they got out of. Where did the car go? Where did everybody meet? Where did that car start out? Running it backwards to track all of that. So they were doing that in West Baltimore. We saw a helicopter that was doing the same thing when we were at Standing Rock. We saw the same thing there. And then in Charlottesville, there was a helicopter that was circling there, very low, and doing the same thing. What happened? The helicopter crashed and three state troopers were killed. But the newspaper articles acknowledged that they were doing surveillance. The papers acknowledged it. So we're not going to be afraid to do things, but we have to pay attention to the fact that they're using technology that is so strong. If you can see planets light years away, and then you shine that down at Earth, you can probably read the buttons that people are wearing or what their T-shirts say. So we just want to be aware of these things. And then the last technology I want to talk about, and there's a lot more, is facial recognition. Facial recognition is now being used to identify people's faces at protests, at airports, everywhere else. And it has the same high digital power, but there's also pushback. Just last week, the city of San Francisco voted against the use of facial recognition in San Francisco. So we've got to push back in other cities so that these cities are not using this as part of their police departments, because as soon as they talk about fighting crime, they're really talking about fighting protests. Last one. Now, when we're dealing with organizations, and this is a critical one, because this is what the whole goal was in stopping the Black Panther Party. One of the first things that we have to do is stop, as I said earlier, believing that they are invincible and that they can crush us and that there's nothing we can do about it. But one of the things that we have to do is stop undermining ourselves by spreading stories and talking about people and doing it in ways that undermine our own work. One of the things I learned from the Black Panther Party is a saying that I can't tell you I've said thousands of times. No investigation, no right to speak. No investigation, no right to speak. So when people sit around the meetings, oh yeah, that person's an agent, you know, and then somebody else hears it and they pass it along, this is irresponsible. It's a way to bring people down. People have died behind those kinds of ignorant passages of claims that are just passed around. So we have to put that in check. And we have to tell people, and I've done this in meetings, when somebody says that, we were preparing for the RNC, and somebody in one of our training meetings, we had like 40 or 50 people there, said, you know, that guy who was here during the first half of the training, he's an agent. Now, I'm sitting up there facilitating things, and like, now, what am I going to do with this? So I said, excuse me, brother, our policy is anyone who publicly announces that somebody is an agent is immediately under suspicion themselves. Please, tell us about yourself. He shrunk back and had nothing else to say. We have to nip that stuff in the bud, because he could have been a knucklehead just talking, or he could have been a ninja trying to put a bad jacket on somebody else and get somebody else done. Poor guy was wearing a little sports jacket because he came from the Civilian Review Board. So this knucklehead is thinking this guy's not wearing jeans and T-shirt, so he's got to be the agent. Well, you know what the agent is wearing? What? Probably wearing the Mumia T-shirt. So come on, we have to do better than that. Also, we have to build consensus within our organizations and stop doing things by up and down votes. That builds factions, that builds bitterness, and it causes dissension. We have to build evaluations and self-criticism into our meetings, because people leave the meeting, and what do? They go off into their little factions, and they start talking about, yeah, who did they think they were trying to overturn my motion and all that. You got issues? We bring it up in the meeting and clear the air so that the rumors don't spread. Anybody ever play telephone? What happens when you get from to the other side of the circle? Go ahead, one person. Go ahead, what'd you say? Something completely different. What did you say? Messed up. That's the legal word for what happens. And people have died from this kind of telephone stuff. We also need to have our organizations establish security. So many times we don't pay attention to that. Have you trained any of your people in security? Or is everybody just sort of thinking, well, we'll all just kind of look out for each other? Have you set aside plans for your event? Are there plans for if something happens here or something happens at one of your public meetings or at one of the protests? Are there contingencies if something jumps off? Who's going to do what? Who's going to call who? Who's going to reach out to the lawyers? Who's going to call the doctors? What are we going to do if there's a raid? We have to build this stuff in, because our reactions to this stuff, our failure to react, can undermine us more than any agent could, our lack of preparation. When there is harassment, we have to publicize the harassment. Don't just keep quiet about it. Collect the information, spread the word, be careful about what you say or don't say. Reach out to the media, to all the powerful people you know, to get the word out and turn the rocks out from under this, because when you're quiet, you're going to get hit again.
That was King Downing of the National Conference of Black Lawyers.
50 years ago, the FBI designated the Black Panther Party the greatest domestic threat to U.S. national security and try to destroy the organization through a campaign of assassination and imprisonment. Johanna Fernandez is with the campaign to bring home Mumia Abu-Jamal. She's also a professor of history and African American studies at Baruch College.
The Sedition Acts, the Alien and Sedition Acts, what did they argue? No immigrants, no foreigners, no protesting government. Essentially everything that we're hearing today. No immigrants, no foreigners, no protesting government. That is the formula that the federal government has used, and I say that because we need to essentially establish solidarity with immigrants and with Muslims who are being persecuted both abroad and domestically. What's the second moment? The rise of the Cold War, a moment when the United States becomes hegemonic. We have the Red Scare, which is a response to the labor upheavals of the 1930s. The fight against communism at this moment, bringing it back to race, is combined with the early suppression of the civil rights movement. Part of the job of repression is ideological. It links black struggle with the major foreign threat. So in the 50s, race mixing is denigrated as communism. So the struggle for civil rights is in fact denigrated as communism because communism is the threat of the moment. What's the third moment? That moment came immediately after one of the greatest crises in American history, when the United States faced a fierce challenge from the Vietnamese abroad and from the many social movements at home, especially those built by a radicalized black freedom movement. The Black Panther Party during this period becomes the target of federal homicidal violence. And it's identified as a national security threat. So black resistance and resistance that challenges the status quo of the United States. And black resistance has always done that because black oppression is the biggest contradiction in this notion of American democracy, which is why when black people fight in the United States, people around the world listen. Most recently, the Palestinians, people in Brazil, in London, and around the world were building Black Lives Matter movements in solidarity with the United States. It has happened in every moment in history. Black oppression is the biggest contradiction in the notion of American freedom and democracy. And so for that reason, when the Black Panthers organize and they begin to establish solidarity with the Vietnamese, they become national security threat number one. Again, there's an ideological campaign at work here. And what does that look like in the 1960s? When historically oppressed people became the unequivocal vanguard of political dissent in the United States and around the world, I'm talking about black people and other people of color, repression, political repression, acquires a new patina. The U.S. government now weaponizes anti-communism with race ideology because all of the people who were organizing in the 60s were colored with the communist brush. But now they're not just communists, they're not just reds, they're also black. So Black Panthers are communists, but they're also the people who are going to break the law, right? That's the race ideology that colors repression in this new period. Government officials, police, and the media begin to equate black, brown, yellow dissent and resistance with run-of-the-mill criminal activity to be feared by law-abiding white citizens. The police in New York followed suit with this very early logic that linked communism with black people. But not just black people with their criminality. In 1966, here in New York, the demand for an independent civilian complaint review board of the police gained traction. In response, the NYPD's union hired a PR firm that ran ads on TV and in billboards across the city to ensure that New Yorkers voted against the Civilian Complaint Review Board. One ad focused on the vulnerability of white women leaving a New York subway station at night in the aftermath of a riot. Riots, resistance, essentially signals the demise of white women. Another of the ads that they ran throughout the city, especially in places like Staten Island and Queens, where white people live, another featured the menacing gaze of black and Puerto Rican youth with switchblades and guns. It ended with the following message of warning, quote, not threatening any person, just a threat to the community. And there's a straight line between that and the Central Park jogger case, right? This is in the 60s, 1966. Then there are statements by New York City Council President Sanford Garalick, whom some of you might remember. He's the New York Council President, but he had previously been part of the Red Squad. He justified the lawless repression and assassination of resistors, of black people. He too weaponized anti-communism with race ideology. He called the Young Lords and the Black Panthers, quote, armed terrorist groups, the outgrowth of an era of disrespect for the law. At that point, the Vietnamese were called terrorists and guerrillas. So the ruling class in New York, the little ruling class in New York, is actually equating our foreign enemy with the Black Panthers and the Young Lords, who were resisting oppression in uncertain terms domestically, and also equating that with violation of the law. He was part of the Red Squad. Oh my God, I have Mumia Abu-Jamal here, who wasn't supposed to call, but let's ask him a question.
All right.
Hello? Hello?
Hey. How are you? Eating again, eh?
What was that?
Eating again, ain't you?
No, I'm not eating. No, I'm not eating. I'm actually giving a talk on black identity extremism, and we're here at the People's Forum, and your friends are here, including Mr. Ford, who visited you not too long ago. We're wondering if you want to share your thoughts with us.
I'd be glad to. May I do it now?
Yes. We're
fighting.
Yes.
Woo! On the move, y'all. When I hear about this black identity situation and how it is being treated by the state, it's almost like COINTELPRO 3.0, the rebirth of the criminalization of the black freedom movement at a time when we are seeing an unprecedented rise in violent, deadly, white terrorism and white supremacy all across the country. It gives you some sense, does it not, of the very nature of the state, yes, but of the armed elements of the state, the so-called police, the so-called FBI, named after a racist J. Edgar Hoover, whose name still graces the building in Washington. This was a man who was obsessed with black power movements, a man who criminalized any kind of black consciousness, of black action, of black resistance, indeed of black prominence itself. We're reminded when we think of the COINTELPRO papers, of someone like Richard Claxton Gregory, known popularly as Dick Gregory. Did you know he was in the black militant files, the hate files? He was identified as a black activist, and therefore the FBI shared his critique of the mafia, which he compared to a snake, with members of the mafia. Think about that. They were trying to get the mafia to do their dirty work, right?
Right.
Okay, now you know where I'm calling from. But this is a time that, you know, we should take very seriously. strengthen our movements, build our movements, but also instruct young people of the potential for something very deadly, very ugly. Who can forget the FBI's role in the assassination of Fred Hampton in his bed, December 6, 1969? They used the lieutenant of security, a rat, an informant, an agent provocateur, to not only draw up a floor plan of the apartment in Chicago, but to specifically identify which bed Fred Hampton and his wife would be sleeping in, his pregnant wife at that time, but also to dose his drink with Zecobarbital to make sure he would be in a deep sleep when they raided. Black consciousness has always and will always be an enemy of white supremacy.
Woo!
Impromptu, thank you.
Yes.
Free Mumia. Free Mumia.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.